Welcome back. You're on Radio Autonomía on Brick Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM. We're here with a member of the Energy Solidarity Cooperative. Would you like to say hello?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming to talk to us. So we wanted to start off by who is the Energy Solidarity Cooperative and what is your mission?
Yeah, for sure. So we are organizers, energy practitioners, educators, and researchers based in Oakland, California. And we are committed to building a movement of energy resilience and economic justice. We envision a world where community energy planning and community-led renewable energy are part of everyday life. So that was our mission, just briefly, and a little overview is of what we do. We connect community groups, particularly in underserved areas, with financing and ownership models for solar electric systems. We also collaborate with groups to develop educational programming and skills exchanges surrounded these on-site renewable energy projects.
Okay, so why did you decide to have a cooperative model with your work?
Yeah, so that's a really important question, a really important part of what we do day to day. And it really started with the way that we thought that how we organize politically and legally will inherently affect our process and thus our impact on the community. And so thus our internal structure had to align with the principles and framework of our work, which is resilience and justice. So we needed an accessible, autonomous model that could effectively engage various stakeholders and hold the profit motive accountable. So we needed to box in the profit motive, and I think that's a really good, that's one of the really key features of our cooperative. And we needed to prioritize community needs over shareholder needs. So we had to think strategically about, you know, the current way that startups and new organizations are funded, and we really wanted to avoid venture capitalists and their obsession with growth. And so the simple answer was forming as a co-op. Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering also how your model differs from other programs that aim to provide solar energy services to underserved communities, programs like the Grid Alternatives program that help install solar panel systems on the roofs of qualifying low-income homes for free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Grid is a really great group helping low-income homeowners, but the thing is that's only a small part of the larger population. A lot of low-income folks and underserved folks, they don't necessarily have their own home, so they can't necessarily afford, or they don't have that home ownership. So I think what our model does is we're looking at different folks who have been left out of sort of this solar revolution, quote-unquote, to date. And a lot of that is these small and medium community groups and organizations. And then there's also the individuals who, you know, are renters, they don't own their own homes, or they don't have a large enough roof, or there's shading obstacles or something, you know, to put solar on the roof. So we're also trying to create a model that will be able to include those individuals and let them participate in a local project. But right now we're currently helping community groups. So not homeowners like Grid Alternatives, but nonprofits, collectives, other co-ops, and then multi-tenant buildings also.
Yeah. So how would it look like for people who maybe don't own their own home to be able to, like, maybe in the future when you start working with, like, individuals, how would that look like instead of, you know, people having to rely on a home that you own?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is where I think a multi-stakeholder cooperative is really useful, and just to give you a little background on what that is. So a lot of co-ops, they have one sort of main member class. So, you know, we have worker co-ops, you have producer co-ops, consumer co-ops. And what our model really does, and we realize with the sort of complexity of the energy field, we had to balance various stakeholders. So there's worker members, folks like myself, there's consumer members, so that's both, you know, those institutions, community groups, and potentially individuals. And then there's another role for folks. It's not a membership role, but it's for community investors. So it's a way that we can finance some of these projects, because understanding that a lot of underserved areas and low-income communities don't have that, you know, the large sort of capital costs for these sorts of projects. So that's a little bit about our sort of multi-stakeholder structure. But the way we envision this for individuals is for individuals to be able to participate in a local project. So what that means is having, you know, maybe finding a suitable site in their local community. You know, it could be a community center, could be a brownfield. It's, you know, it needs to be a project where local community members come together, figure out what's the most optimal site. Obviously, our roofs is not doing it. And then how can we actually have an ownership stake in that project? So instead of one private developer owning the rights, all of that energy, selling that back to the monopoly, the grid owner, how do individuals own a portion of that? So, you know, how do I own 4 or 5 panels in that project? How do you own 4 or 5 panels or more in this project? And how do we go about this collectively? And, you know, by each being an individual member of the cooperative and this being a project of the cooperative, we see that as a really good way of going about it. But currently, those projects in California aren't legal. And so, you know, they've literally, the regulation has set it so that it's just a lot easier to do things that sort of, that are much less resilient for the community and sort of empower these monopoly structures that we've historically had and make it really difficult to move towards decentralized energy systems. But that's where we're working. We're working on the sort of political level there and trying to allow for those sorts of projects to take hold.
Mm-hmm. So since you touched on it a little bit right now, how would you all define energy resiliency?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of different ways to look at that, different contexts, but I think the way that we see it is, you know, it's really linking the struggles within labor and ecology, and really avoiding carbon myopia, you know, and I think that's where, you know, there's a lot of clean energy projects are happening currently, you know, a lot of sort of mega scale, large scale projects that just, you know, it's the same old, and, you know, and maybe it's not fossil fuel generated, but the process, it's much more of a transaction than a transformative process. So I think, you know, that's something that's a really key feature of energy resilience, you know, this transformative process. And I think it also means, you know, putting community ownership first, you know, and foremost. So instead of having foreign developers and other private interests owning these really key resources, I think it really means getting the community involved in that process, and making sure that, you know, individuals and community members are the ones who are benefiting in the long term the most, you know, rather than shareholders, which that's currently how it's going. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in terms of your vision when looking at energy resilience, maybe using a little bit of radical imagination now, what do you think this would look like on the scale of a city like Oakland, perhaps, or even on a larger scale?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think on the infrastructure level, it looks like locally owned microgrids and decentralized distributed renewable energy. And so that means, like, you know, in our context, not having, you know, a PG&E, not having a monopoly utility provider, having lots of different autonomous individual microgrids. Actually, not just owning the generation, but, you know, the transmission and the grid. It's a long way to go, but we're seeing it happen in different parts of the world. And especially parts of the world that don't have this sort of regulated structure. So a lot of the global south is sort of taking advantage of this too, you know, and figuring out that, you know, we really actually need to move towards microgrids rather than going through, you know, centralized fossil fuel generation. So I think, yeah, on the infrastructural level, that's what it looks like a little bit. And that includes, you know, like, I think community-owned wind, community solar, community geothermal, various different sources, technology appropriate, culturally appropriate technology. But then I think it's really important that on the social and cultural level, it results in a highly accessible, accountable, and autonomous process. So, you know, those are three really big A's for us: accessibility, accountability, and you know, autonomous and being autonomous as an organization, as a community. So I think that's a little bit what it looks like.
What do you mean by accountable within that?
For sure. So I think that really speaks to sort of how private entities are accountable to their shareholders. And I think this specifically accountability and our work is the fact that we are a member-owned cooperative. That means, you know, our shareholders are our members. And so at the end of the day, you know, we put first how we serve ourselves and how we serve our community rather than just solely profit. And I think, you know, it's definitely the process in which we do that. So we have a one vote, one member, one vote process that, you know, gets away from, you know, having a sort of, you know, an executive team or sort of a board of directors who sort of, you know, really drive the narrative and the organization forward. And I think for us, it's being based in community and being a member-owned organization that makes us accountable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a little bit about also wind and other technologies, but you all focus on solar energy specifically.
Right. Yeah, so currently we focus on solar. We've had a lot of conversations about this, but I think it's, you know, we're right now we're focusing all our work in the Bay Area, specifically the East Bay, Oakland and Richmond. And, you know, being in California, we have a huge solar resource and a pretty good sort of regulatory structure for solar. And it's becoming a lot more cost effective for folks. And so it's sort of, we see it being an entry point, a really good entry point. But, you know, it doesn't work for all communities and it doesn't work for all sites. And I think, you know, and for us, you know, we're not trying to push an agenda of sort of like one technology in one way. You know, I think we're thinking about this a little bit more holistically. So I think we it makes sense to work on solar electric projects right now. And I think going forward, we'll definitely entertain some different technologies.
Cool. Do you think you could give us an example of one of your projects? Tell us a little bit about something that's going on, like at a school or a nonprofit.
Yeah. So one of our projects right now is we're working with the Street Academy, the Emiliano Zapata Street Academy in Oakland. We're helping them doing a lot of curriculum development, figuring out different ways to engage the students in this process and helping them, you know, get a solar electric system. I think what's really interesting with this example is we've seen, especially in California, there's quite a few schools who have gone solar. But if you look at how that process happens, it's really, you know, it's a private developer coming in, throwing up some panels, getting out of there. And I think there's, you know, for us, it's really exciting because I think there's a lot of lost opportunity there. And there's so many ways to engage the students, faculty, and community through this process. And I think that's been a really exciting part of what we're doing. So we're talking about getting involved not only in the math and physics class in terms of the curriculum that's related to this project, but talking about their political economy, talking about this in their history classes, you know, talking about this even in their gardening classes. So we're, you know, one of our last meetings, we're talking about the nexus of food and energy. I'm talking about how important that is for students to be able to think about this, you know, in a broader sense. And so I think that's really exciting. And I mean, it's a small school that's very mission value. It has a lot of great aligned mission and values with us. And just a little bit more background on them. They're a continuation high school, you know, so there's a lot of, you know, quote unquote dropouts or sort of folks who have found it a little bit difficult with the public education system, but they're still a public school, but they have autonomy from the district. So their curriculum is much different than the regular public school education. That's why they have gardening electives, you know, they have mural classes, they have a really integrated, holistic curriculum that makes sort of this project, what we're doing, sort of even more easier.
So what are the resources that you're offering then as a cooperative there? You're saying that you have a class with the students, but also showing them how to install solar panels, or how does that work?
Yeah, so I think it's getting them involved in the project from day one. So we find different ways to get them involved. So, for example, on a solar project, you know, we start with some of the design considerations. So we're talking about, like, well, how much space do we have in the school? How much solar potential do we have in the school? These are things that the students can be actively involved in this, you know, trying to figure out. What would the most effective system look like? How do we do this without taking up too much space? So that's one of the things. They have a really large playground area, and it's like, well, how do we do this without, you know, infringing on other space? How do we, you know, one idea we've had is doing a sort of carport thing. So having a car shade, having panels that are car shades, and so you're not taking up space on the ground, but, you know, where you have cars that are parking, they have a parking structure. And on top of that parking structure are the solar panels. So, you know, if it's figuring out with the students and faculty what's the most effective way to use space, what's the most effective type of project here. And I think it's also, you know, we've talked about doing sites to other, we talked about doing sites to the Richmond Refinery, we talked about doing it to the other solar installations, and really engaging the students with, you know, how these different types of energy generation differ. So what does centralized fossil fuel generation look like? What are its impacts on the local community? and now what is this that we're getting involved in, and what does this process look like? Mm-hmm. And trying to engage them really at every point in this process. So you know, there's some liability issues in terms of like getting the kids involved in the installation, but there's a lot of excitement, and they want to be a part of every part of this, and you don't blame them, because you know there's so much to take from this process. There's so much to go both ways.
Cool. Well, part of our other segments are also talking about climate justice, and I'm wondering if you all consider yourselves a climate justice organization, or how you see yourself in relation to the climate justice movements.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's something we've thought about for a while. As we engage different organizations, it's something that comes up, and I think the way that I kind of see it is that, you know, there's different parts. It's really hard to sort of summarize the climate justice movement in sort of, you know, in one or in a few sentences, or even like a sort of a type of work or a type of organization. And I think there's different strands within it. And, you know, we're not doing, you know, frontline direct action work necessarily, in sort of, you know, a certain type of climate justice work. But I think we definitely fit into that. We fit into this larger movement, and I think we fit into it as, you know, trying to build the alternatives. You know, it's like and not saying what's more important. I think it takes both things, but, you know, we need the direct action, frontline work and protests to be able to, you know, to be able to stop sort of currently what's happening and stop the exploitation, but we also need to be building the future, right? And I think there's a lot been happening in both realms. I think a lot of our work is focused on the second part, but I mean, the reason, you know, the underpinnings is the former, you know, and all the work, I think we're building off of that work that's really trying to stop a certain type of system, and now it's implementing the alternatives. And I think they go hand in hand, even though, you know, maybe the former gets talked about a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. So how could people join the cooperative, or what are some other ways to get involved or to volunteer with ESC?
Yeah, so if you're local, you know, there's lots of ways to get involved. If you're interested in being a worker member, feel free to reach out to us through our website, esc.coop. And you know, if you're an organization, if you're a community group, particularly in Oakland and Richmond, or you're an individual who thinks that a community group would be interested in developing a project in partnership with us, you know, reach out to us, get in touch. And then I would say, you know, stay in touch, because we're going to be, like I said before, expanding our model to individuals who can directly get involved. But currently, you know, we are limited just to community groups. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any public events that people could attend?
Yes, we do. Coming up on Wednesday at 6 p.m., we're doing a workshop teaching at the Liberating Ourselves Locally Makerspace in Fruitvale. And this is in partnership with the Sustainable Economies Law Center. And we're going to be talking about a lot of what we talked about today, but just expanding a little bit, talking about energy resilience and what that really means for the community. And talking a little bit about how individuals, community members, and institutions in Fruitvale can get involved in community renewable energy. So yeah, check it out.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing about the ESC with us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Cool. Lágrima de mar, 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 mar. Tristeza de agua, tristeza de agua. Lágrima de mar, mar, mar. Tristeza de agua, 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 agua. Para esta lluvia ácida no se inventó ningún paraguas. Agua, agua, agua. Acá cada cual lleva su marca. Marca. Una gota, una estrella, una frase. Si no hay tatuajes, observaremos tus lunares. Mirando inventaremos nuevos sistemas solares.